We're going to read from God's Word now in the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 5. That's on page 555 if you're using the church Bible. Chapter 5, and we begin to read in verse 8. And we're going to read from verse 8 through to the end of chapter 6. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. This is gain for a land in every way, the king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a labourer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment. In all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honour, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It's a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Well, perhaps we can open our Bibles in Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, on page 555. If I can just take two verses to focus our attention on, although we'll be looking at the whole passage. But there are two verses in particular. In chapter 5 and verse 13, we read these words: "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt." And then at the beginning of chapter 6, in verse 1, we read, "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. The preacher, the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, who describes himself in that way, the preacher, is still looking at life under the sun. It's almost as though he's seeking to draw a horizontal line under the sun so he can look at life without any kind of vertical connection. He's cutting God out of the picture. You know what it's like when people say that to us, and you speak to them about Christianity, and you say something perhaps in conversation, and they say, don't they, very often, oh, let's leave God out of it. Why do you have to bring God into it all the time? Don't they say that? Why do you have to bring God into it all the time? Well, the preacher says, well, go on then, let's do that, shall we? Let's leave God out of it. And let's see where that gets us. And really, the whole of the book can be looked at in that way. That's simply what he's doing. And the preacher's verdict, he tells us right at the beginning of the book and over and over and over again, he keeps telling us through this book, doesn't he, that when you cut God out of the picture, there's only one word that can really describe human existence and life in this world without God, and that is the word vanity. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. He can't emphasize it enough. And over again, I think some 40 times in the 12 chapters, he describes life in that way. It's vanity. And he describes it a few times in this passage itself. Well, vanity, what is vanity? Well, it simply means empty and void. When you cut God out of the picture, what are you left with? You're left with an empty life, an empty existence. And the problem that we have in this world when we cut God out of the picture is that we have to find something to fill that void, don't we? And so many people will try to fill that void with materialism. Isn't that the case? Now, there are two forms of materialism that we need to be aware of. There are two different, we're talking about two different things, really. But one form of materialism can be described in the phrase, the belief, that matter is all that there is. So an atheist is a materialist, someone who believes that this is all there is, and that when you're dead, and that's the end of it, and there's no more to life, there is no God, this is all there is, and everything that you can see and touch and feel with your senses, that is what there is, and there is no more. There's no such thing as the spiritual world. There is no such thing as heaven. There is no such thing as God, and so on. That's a materialist in this sense. It's someone who believes that matter is all that there is. But there's another form of materialism. And that is to believe that matter is all that matters. And that's different. You can believe that matter is all that matters without having to be an atheist. You can be a believer in God and still be a materialist, in other words. But you're a materialist then, not in ideology, but certainly in practice. And the way that the Bible describes that, for example, in Romans chapter 1, Paul talks to us, doesn't he, of those who try and substitute things for God. And he says, these people worship and serve the creation rather than the Creator. And that's the subject of the topic, the subject that Ecclesiastes takes up now here in chapter 5 and verse 8 and following. One of my favorite parts of Pilgrim's Progress is that picture of the man with the muck rake. I've referred to it many, many times, and I'm sure I will again, because it really is such a graphic description, isn't it, of life in this world for many, many people. Isn't that true? And you know the picture, well, I've referred to it before, but there's this man, and he's got this rake in his hand, and he's just raking the dirt to himself and the sticks and the stones that come with it. And there he is, and he's working hard at it, isn't he? He's toiling at raking these things to himself. And it's almost as though he's looking for life, but he's looking for life in the earth, isn't he? And he's looking for life in these things, and he brings these things to himself. And all the while, he is totally oblivious of the crown of life that's just above his head. It's being offered to him. Free grace and salvation, eternal life with God in this crown of righteousness that's just within his reach, but he never looks up because he's so busy raking the dirt and the things of this earth to himself that he misses the most important thing in life. And that's the picture, not just in the man in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, but that's the picture that we have here in this passage as well, isn't it? And the world is full. The world is rammed full of people just like that. Whether they believe in God or not, they're living for this world and for the things of this world. And you see what Ecclesiastes, the way he describes that kind of life here in these verses. You see it there in verse 13, the verse that we read. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches that were kept by their owner to his hurt. And then again in chapter 6 and verse 1, you remember, he says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun. And the New International Version translates it in this way. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. Sorry, the AV translated in that way. And it is common among men. That's true, isn't it? It's common among men. Paul, in the passage that we read in 1 Timothy, says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. The Bible calls it filthy lucre, doesn't it? Filthy lucre. And it calls it that not because it dirties your hands, but because it dirties your heart. And Ecclesiastes says it's a common thing among men. It's what people live for. In the words of Lisa Minnelli, I think it was, it's what makes the world go round. Money, money, money. Money makes the world go round, and it's true, isn't it? But why? Why is money so important to people? Because it's a substitute for God. It's something to fill the void, isn't it? We have substituted mammon for the God who gives us life. We're seeking in some way or another to fill the void. But the problem is that whatever we fill that void with becomes our God. That's why the New Testament calls it idolatry. We wouldn't dream, would we, in our society? We wouldn't dream of bowing down to some golden image of some sort, would we? I mean, that would be absolutely abhorrent in our life. We're far too sophisticated to bow down to images, aren't we? And yet, in our life, in our world, in the society in which we live, many, many people will think nothing of making a god of money. And Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either you will serve God or you will serve money, but you can't serve them both. But why does he put them both in the same context? Because that's what money becomes. It becomes our God if we're not careful. Isn't that true? I mean, do I have to prove that? Do you want me to give you some figures? Why is it that 2/3 of the world today haven't got enough to eat? 2/3 of the world population, how many is that? 4 billion people or something like that? Haven't really got enough to eat. Is it because there's not enough food in the world to go around? Why is it that people say, oh, I can't believe in God? When you look at all the starving millions that there are, well, why are the millions starving? Because money is more important. And the preacher here illustrates that point, doesn't he? In verses 8 and 9, look at what he says. He says, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. And then if I can read the last verse, that verse 9, in the words, in the translation of the NIV, I'll read it like this. I think it's a better translation. He says, The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the land. You see what he's saying? Why do the rich get richer and the poor get poorer in this world? Why is it that everyone's on the take? Why is there so much corruption in high places? That's what he's talking about there, isn't it? You know, the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness. He says, don't be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there's yet higher ones over them, even the king's at it. That's what he's saying. Why is it that corruption goes all the way to the top, and the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Why is it so common to man, as he describes here? Why? Why is it that we get hot under the collar about this corruption that we see, the corruption that we see in high places? You see what he says there in verse 8? It's amazing, isn't it? He says, don't be amazed at it. And yet we are. We get all upset about it. Somebody ought to do something. This has got to stop. And the socialists and the communists, they get on their high horse and they say, well, that's not right. Let's do this. And we'll change it in this way. But he says, don't be amazed at the matter. Why not? Because that's human nature. This is inevitable when you leave God out of the picture. Isn't that what he's saying? Man has to fill the void with something. And so very, very often, it's this. That's why it's so common, isn't it? And so in every age, he's writing this 3,000 years ago, but in every age and in every place, all over the world, we still see it today. There's corruption in high places. And everyone seems to be on the take. I mean, today, there's more emphasis, isn't there, on fair trade. Fair trade, that's a good thing, isn't it? Good thing to think about fair trade. But why is the emphasis now on fair trade rather than aid? Because the aid doesn't get there, does it? It doesn't get to where it's needed. The aid very often is sort of cream off the top, don't they? And the governments take it all, and the people who really need it, well, they don't seem to get it. So it's far better to work with fair trade and so on. And basically, things don't change, do they? It's the same now as it was then, and it always will be. We shouldn't be amazed at these things, because this is what human nature is like. And the trouble, surely, is that it's easy for us to see the problem when we're looking over there. And we see the corruption in the government and the things that are going on over there, as it were. And something has to be done, and this ought to stop. And yet we're blind to the same problem in our own hearts. He says it's common to man. It's all over the world. Yes, it is. But why? Where do these things come from? Jesus says, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts and murder and greed and so on. Out of the heart of man. We're blind very often to what is in our own hearts. And that really is what the preacher is really concerned about. I think that the preacher here is not so much talking about society and the corruption in society and so on. He's talking rather about the individual and the damage that it does to the individual. Isn't that the emphasis there in verse 13 again, isn't it? There's a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. To his own hurt. He's concerned about the hurts that it does to the individual. And what we have in the rest of this passage are the observations of the preacher regarding this common evil that there is among mankind. And what he's saying to us all through this passage is, okay, you think it's okay to live like that? Well, let's have a look, shall we? Let's have a look at the problem. And he tells us some very familiar things in this passage, doesn't he? Because there's nothing new about this. It's a common problem all through all the generations. But we need to face up to it. We better not just shrug it off and say, well, that's life. That's the way of the world. Money makes the world go round. So let's get on with it. No, he's saying, look, take a good look. Take a good look at this problem. And there are three things that he says in this passage. There's probably more, but let me just point out to you three things that he says in this passage about the problem of materialism. And the first thing he says is that it's unsatisfying. Look at verses 10 and 11. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? See what he's saying? Materialism. It's like drinking pop, isn't it? You know what it's like? You've been out in the garden, you've been had a hard day in the sun, and you've been working hard, and you come in and you're really, really thirsty. And you go to the fridge and you open the fridge and there's this can of Coke. And this beautiful red can, and it's dripping on the outside because it's just so cold, and it's just, oh, wow. And you can't wait, can you? So you take out this can of Coke and you start to drink, and doesn't it feel good? It does, doesn't it? And it starts going down, you're so thirsty, just imagine you're so thirsty that you fight the bubbles in your back of your throat and you just down it in one because it's so good. And what a great feeling it is to drink that Coke. But you and I know, don't you, don't we, that you're actually thirstier after you've drank the Coke than you were before you drank it. That's what they tell us. It's true that it satisfies the thirst immediately, for a few moments perhaps. But in reality, you're more thirsty now after the Coke than you were before. Why? Because Coke doesn't satisfy real thirst. And that's what he's saying here about materialism. That's its problem, isn't it? He who loves money will not be satisfied with it. You won't be. He who loves wealth will not be satisfied with his income. We always want more. That's the problem, isn't it? It's like an addiction. I mean, you wouldn't dream of becoming addicted to drugs of any kind, I'm sure. Because you know what it's like and the damage it can do to you. And the problem with drugs, of course, is that you constantly have to gratify the craving that you have, but it's never enough. And you always want more. And isn't that what the preacher's telling us about materialism? You'll never be satisfied. If that's what your life is all about, you're never going to be satisfied. Jesus says in John 4 to the woman at the well, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. Well, what's he talking about? He's certainly not talking about the water in the well. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? We have to drink physically all the time. But he's not talking about that, is he? He's talking about the way of life, isn't he? He's talking about the world, really. I mean, in the context of that woman, it's the way she was trying to gratify her desires and her needs. And she thought that she could do so with this man, and then another man, and then another man. And it was relationships, wasn't it? She was trying to satisfy her needs in that way. But Jesus says, you'll never do it. He who drinks this water will be thirsty again. And he's talking about lifestyle, isn't he? And what he's saying there, surely, is that the world will never quench the thirst of the soul, the real needs of man. Now, we know that as Christians, don't we? We know that. So why do we do it? I mean, it's not just I'm not referring now really to just materialism, but all sin and all worldliness and all efforts to satisfy our cravings in that way. We know it won't satisfy at the end. But it's true of materialism as well. This water will leave you thirsty again. And the preacher illustrates that for us, doesn't he? Look at chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2. You see what he says? There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it's common to man. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It's a grievous evil. He describes this man who's got it all. When we used to live in Mallorca, we would often go down to the harbour. In the bay there, there was this wonderful little harbour, and the cathedral was built there, and it was all lit up at night, and it was a beautiful place to go for a walk. But it was not only the cathedral and the scenery and so on. We'd often go for a walk down by the boats, by the yachts. Well, I can tell you something. You can see some wealth there that you can only imagine. You wouldn't ever in your life be able to achieve such a thing. These wonderful yachts, and there was a beauty about them all, the precision of it all, and the sleekness of it all, and the money, and everything. Mallorca, of course, is a home for the rich and famous. There's many, many people, famous people live on Mallorca, and they've got these wonderful posh houses and villas up in the mountains, and it's a... And he describes here in this verse someone who's got everything. Everything that he could possibly want. And he lacks nothing that all his desires. He's got everything this world has to offer. But he hasn't got the ability to enjoy it. And he says, he can't enjoy it, but a stranger enjoys them. Now, we don't know why. We're not told in that verse what happens. It's probably referring to chapter 2, where he talks about the possibility of gaining and gaining and gaining more wealth and yet just handing it on to siblings or someone else when we die, and you don't know what they're going to do with it. But that happens, doesn't it? And you say, well, it does happen, but not always. Some people live long, don't they? And they live on into their years and years, and they enjoy their material goods, don't they? And then he describes in verses 3 to 6 another case. And this time it's a father who has hundreds of children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many. But his soul is not satisfied with life's goods, and so on. And he finishes all in verse 6 and says, even though he should live 2,000 years, or sorry, 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. They not all go to the one place. You see what he's saying? It's possible, isn't it, to have everything. He's got everything. It's very Old Testament verses 3 to 6, because in the Old Testament, children were regarded as an economic asset. As an economic asset. And what he's saying there is that this man, well, his future is secured. He's got all the kids he needs, and they're going to look after him in his old age. So he's got his insurance sorted, and he's got his retirement plan. And he lives a long, long time, 2,000 years, he says. And yet his soul is not satisfied with life's goods. Why does he describe it that way? He's obviously talking about, I hope it's never going to happen, is it? Twice as long as Methuselah. Well, nobody's lived that long. So he's talking about an impossible situation, isn't he? But he's exaggerating, isn't he? But the point of what he's saying is simply this, isn't it? More is needed than goods and safety and security. And it's not about how much you've got and how long you live. Both of those things don't necessarily mean satisfaction. Why not? Well, that brings us on to the second point. Materialism is unsatisfying, but secondly, there's an uncertainty about it. And at the same time, there is a certainty as well. He illustrates that in chapter 5 and verse 13 and 14. See what he says there. There is a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. Imagine the headlines in the newspapers, the local newspapers in that day. Local businessman goes bankrupt. And he's got nothing to hand on to his children now, he says. He loses everything. And he's talking about the uncertainty of riches. and the fact that we can lose, and that happens, doesn't it? Time and time again. I mean, how often do we need to see the crash of the stock market and so on? And these are uncertain riches. We can't put our trust in those things, can we? Because they're uncertain. But you say, well, maybe some people lose them in that way, but not all of us. We will, you know. That's why he goes on in verses 15 and 16 to say what he does. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. Just as he came, so shall he go, and what gain is there for all the toil? For him who toils for the wind. You see what he's saying. He says there's an uncertainty about riches. You don't know when you're going to lose them. You don't know when you might be taken from this world, like the rich fool in Luke chapter 12. You don't know when you're going to lose all these things, but eventually you will. Every single one of us will. And death is the final mockery of materialism, doesn't it? Isn't it? We bring nothing into this world, and you will take nothing out of it. That doesn't need explaining. No one can argue with that. You might argue with a number of things that I've said tonight, I don't know, but you can't argue with that, can you? That's a fact. It's undeniable. It's there, isn't it? I mean, the Egyptians wanted to believe that that wasn't the case, and so they buried treasures for all of their pharaohs and their officials, and so, but they're still there in the tomb or in some museum now, aren't they? They took nothing with them. Naked, says Ecclesiastes here. That's a very powerful word, isn't it, when you think about it? Naked they came, and naked they shall depart. There's something very poignant. Not even the clothes on your back. Nothing. 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 And we need to ponder on these things because it's a certainty. It's an absolute certainty. Someone commented and said, if death means all is over and there is nothing more than this, then life is pervaded with tragic irrationality. Every column of the great human account of our life, every column of the great human account book of our life adds up to the same sum total. Zero. You know it and I know it. But have you faced up to it? Is that something that is part of your Christian life? Jesus says, don't lay up treasures for yourself where thieves break in and moth and rust destroy. Because it's chasing after the wind. It's emptiness. And then thirdly, he says here that it's unhealthy. It's not only unsatisfying and there's an uncertainty and yet a certainty about it, but there's an unhealthiness to it as well. Look at verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? I don't know if you've ever heard of William, nicknamed Bud Post. William Bud Post. Well, in 1988 in Philadelphia in America, he won $16.2 million on the lottery. Within 1 year, he was not only broke, but he was £1 million in debt. His girlfriend, or his ex-girlfriend rather, sued him successfully for a third of the winnings. And listen, his brother literally arranged for a hitman to bump him off, thinking that he would be the inheritor of such wealth. Not long afterwards, William Post said, I wish it had never happened. I was much happier when I was broke. And that's what Ecclesiastes is telling us in verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? You see the problem when you get rich like that, all of a sudden, isn't it true that everyone wants a slice? The hangers-on won't leave you alone. And who wants to live like that? It's harmful to your own hurt, isn't it? It's saying there, he kept it to his own hurt, verse 13. And it's not only the hangers-on and the problems that gives, but it brings stress and worry, doesn't it? Thinking about what the stock market's going to be doing and the housing market and wherever your treasure is, how are you going to keep it all and so on? Well, look at what he says in verse 17. So sad. Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and in much vexation and sickness and anger. I mean, what a sad picture that is. You couldn't get any sadder, could you? He's sitting in the dark. I don't know if you've ever done that. You ever been so depressed that you just sat in the dark? I have. But I've never eaten in the dark. I mean, how depressed is this guy? He's so depressed that he's eating on his own and he's eating in the dark. And it's a picture of absolute misery, isn't it? And you see what he's saying here in Ecclesiastes. He's saying there's an unhealthiness to it, isn't there? It has adverse effects. It doesn't even allow us to sleep in verse 12. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much. Oh, but the full stomach of the rich won't let him sleep. It's got adverse effects, hasn't it? But you know, there's something even worse. Not just the stress and the worry and the hangers-on and all of that kind of business. But there's something even worse. It has adverse effects spiritually and morally too, doesn't it? We say, oh, you can't take it with you. And that's absolutely true. But what you will take with you is the way it changes you. That's the scariest thing of all. Remember the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16? Jesus describes a man there in hell. As he was in Hades, he says. There he is looking up, as it were, and you see this terrible situation, this awful picture that the Lord paints there in Luke 16 in that parable. And you ask the question, well, why? Why is he there? Not because he was rich, but because riches had him. Nowhere in the Bible does it condemn people who are rich. It doesn't say that. But it does condemn us when those riches become our God, when they start taking over our life. And that was what the problem with this man in the rich man and Lazarus was. We don't even know his name, do we? But that's the problem there, isn't it? It was the process of becoming rich that actually destroyed that man. And that's what he took with him to the grave and to hell. Because he became less than human in the process, didn't he? Isn't that the picture there? Jesus is saying there in that parable that even the dogs had more compassion than the rich man. He couldn't care less. Walked past him every day on his way to the market or wherever he was going. And yet there's this man and he couldn't care less. He doesn't do anything to help him. Because he's less human now, isn't he? And that's the real problem. That's the worst thing about materialism, isn't it? It takes over and dehumanizes. That's why I read from 1 Timothy chapter 6. He says, now there is great gain in godliness with contentment, for we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of it. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and into a snare in many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. It's part of what Jesus is talking about in the parable of the sower, isn't it? The thorns. The riches of this world, he says, come and choke the spiritual life. out of the seed that was sown. You know, whenever you smoke, there's a health warning on the packet, isn't there? Graphic health warnings. What the scriptures are telling us is that there ought to be health warnings on materialism, on money. Because if you're not very, very, very careful, it will destroy you. And many have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs, he says. Look at what it does to you. That's what the preacher's saying. Look at what it does to you. So what's the answer? Very briefly, what's the answer? Well, it's there in verse 18, chapter 5 and verse 18. Look at what he says. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun a few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Remember the man with the muck rake? When you see somebody like that, and as I say, this world is full of them, but when you see someone like that, don't you feel like saying, just look up, man. Don't you see? You speak to them about the gospel and they don't even see it. They don't understand that there's more to life than just raking muck and twigs and dirt and so on. And you feel like saying to them, just look up, will you? There's more to life. Look at what you're missing. Well, what is he missing? He's telling us there in verses 18 to 20. It's amazing, isn't it? God is almost completely absent from the rest of the passage. But in verses 18 to 20, he focuses on God now, doesn't he? And four times in those three verses, he speaks about God and all that God is doing. And you see what he's doing? He's doing what the preacher really wants to do in all of this book. He's pointing us to God. And he's saying to us, look, there's the answer. There's the real answer to the void that is in your heart. There's the real answer to materialism and the temptations that it involves. What's the answer? Well, it's not aestheticism. It's not austerity. It's not communism or socialism. It's not give it all away. Because you can be poor. You can give it all away and be poor and still not know God and still not know his blessing and still not enjoy life. Don't you see what he's saying? Look, the answer to greed is grace. It's seeing this life and everything in it as the gift of God. Look at verse 20. It's wonderful, beautiful picture. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Life without God is so dry and boring, tedious. Preaching can be like that, can't it? When the preacher goes on and the preacher's struggling perhaps, and I can see it on your faces when it happens. And people sort of glancing up to the clock, or maybe just a little bit of a, oh, how long is this going on for? You know what it's like. Preaching can be like that. Well, life can be like that, can't it? But you know the difference when God comes and he takes up the preaching and the spirit is there. Are you looking at your clock then? You're not, are you? It flies by in a moment. And you, what? I thought he could have just gone on and it wouldn't have mattered. And that, isn't that true? Isn't that when preaching is spirit-filled like that, that's what we love? And isn't that what he's saying there in verse 20? Living with God and living for God. And life is like a flash. It's gone in a moment and you'll be in eternity before you even know it. And oh, what joy will fill your hearts when God is the center. when God is what you're living for, when you're not living for the things of this world, with this world, but God is everything to you. Isn't that what we sang earlier in that hymn? Show me thy face, my faith and love shall henceforth fixed be, and nothing here have power to move my soul's serenity. My life shall seem a trance, a dream, and all I feel and see, elusive, visionary, thou, the one reality. That's what he's talking about. That's the difference, isn't it, that God makes in our lives. That's the difference when we realize that everything we have, whether it's lots or little, whether we're blessed with great wealth or we're living in poverty, when everything we've got, and we know it, is God's gift, and he gives us the ability to enjoy it as well. Well, that changes everything. That's life. That's what life is really all about. And the answer to materialism is not necessarily to give it all away. Maybe it is. But not necessarily. The answer to materialism is what Jesus says in that parable of the rich fool. I referred to it earlier. One verse that we very often miss when we're thinking of that passage, that parable, he finishes in this way. He says, so is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. And that's the key. Rich towards God. That's what Timothy's talking about. Let me just read these verses again and then I'm finished. But in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, it says this, for as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty. He doesn't say, tell them to give it all away, does he? He says, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Let them realize that this is the gift of God. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of, listen, that they may take hold of that which is truly life. What is truly life? Well, he's not talking about length of time, that we might have a long life in this world. He's talking about life eternal, isn't he? He's talking about in the same sense that Jesus is talking in John 17, verse 3. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true and living God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. Why does he mention both, the Father and the Son? Surely he's talking about that fellowship, and we're welcomed in. That's life. We're welcomed into the fellowship of the Trinity. That's where life is found. Not in the muck and the sticks and the stones of this world, whatever it might be made of, gold or whatever. It's not about this world, it's only in Christ and in fellowship with the Father and with the Son. And as John Piper once said, if you don't have God in your life, in your heart, the whole universe will never be able to fill that void. Because it's God-shaped. And it's him we must have.